any listeners who have or have had small children, sometimes you'll try almost anything to get them to sleep. Back in 1995, the Moran family tried to get their 2-year-old John to sleep by taking a drive north out of San Francisco, wound up in wine country. Jump forward to today, and Moran Manor makes some fabulous wine. The journey is chronicled by Richard Moran in his new book, The Accidental Vineyard, and we're very lucky to be joined by him this morning. Good morning, and welcome to Mountain Money.
Good morning. I'm so happy to be here.
So can you please run through the original events, you know, that drive with John not getting to sleep, that led you to that house in Calistoga?
Well, every parent knows that when a child is sick and won't go to sleep or just screams all the time, you'll do anything to get them to try to go to sleep. So what we did, the only thing that worked with our 2-year-old John was take long drives. So we took a long drive one day, and I was purposeless. I just wanted to keep him in the car, and the hum of the car would lull him to sleep, we hope. So I would take turns. I left turn, right turn. I didn't know where I was. And he never did go to sleep, but we drove by this old house that was for sale, and it just spoke to us, you know, pick me, come help me. I need help. I need repairs. And that's what happened. And we did. And it turned out to be the adventure of a lifetime for us.
So set the stage a little more. You're driving and you see, describe what you first saw when you saw this house.
Well, we're in wine country. And as some of your listeners may know, you can go for miles between homes. Everything is a vineyard. So one of our sons saw this big white dot up ahead of us. And as we got closer and closer, it was this old historic home. And we thought it was going to be interesting. So we did stop to look at it. And lo and behold, it was for sale. And it was, it had been for sale for a while, which should have been my first clue that it was not for the faint-hearted. And eventually we did look. And even on the first tour, you know, we could see there was mold on the upper floor. We could look up through the ceiling and see the sky. I didn't know what bat guano smelled like, but I soon discovered that the smell in the house was bat guano. But we were blind to all of that. And I think what stole our heart, Kevin, was that this was a place. And I've never been to the Kennedy compound in New England, but maybe you have, maybe you're related. but whenever it's described, you know, the touch football, the place for the family to gather, that's what early on I envisioned, that this could be our family place for a long time. And it was.
I know in the book you kept checking in with the house or the realtor to see if the price would drop. How long did it take from that Sunday afternoon drive in the Toyota minivan to when you said, we're doing it?
It took almost a year. Wow. Because, and the funny people laugh because I would disguise my voice. I loved the house and I didn't want anyone else to buy it. So I would call the realtor and say, hello, this is Joe Doak. So I'm calling about that fixer upper. And I think she knew all along that it was really me. But I every couple of weeks I'd call and say, is that wreck of a house still available? This is John Miller. And it turned out that it was. So it was kismet. It was fate. It was, as one of our kids said, it was meant to be. So when we finally took possession of the house, then we could, you know, look inside the walls, look inside the fireplaces. That's when we realized that we kept asking our question, what have we done?
When I was reading that section of the book, I was thinking of that Tom Hanks movie, The Money Pit. Do you remember that from the 80s? Holy cow, all the contractors.
I can't tell you how many people have told me to watch that movie. But I didn't want to. I mean, I know that story, and we were living it. And what anyone who is interested in restoring an old home knows, the real expense and the real work is in all the areas that no one sees. You know, so for example, the house had 40 amps of electricity going into it. You have more than that in your watch.
Exactly.
So there were two big fuses in the basement, and if we turned on the toaster and a light at the same time, that those fuses would arc. It would be like Cloris Leachman and Young Frankenstein. The electric would, and then everything would dim. So, but my point is, all the expense, all the work is in things like the new electrical system, the new foundation, the new plumbing, all of that that we take for granted in a newer home.
So there was a point when you were driving two cars from the Bay Area, you know, from the city, and you were listening to Cheaper by the Dozen, book on tape.
Yes.
Was that your defining moment when Brady said, "Dad, you should write a book like this"? Was that it?
Yes, I love that book, Cheaper by the Dozen. And I can't imagine having a dozen children, but four by today's standards is a lot. So they were the ones that said, "Dad, the adventures that you're going through are just like the dad in Cheaper by the Dozen. You should start writing it all down." So I did, and that was the start of a column that I started writing for the Wine Country newspapers, which ultimately became part of the book. But columns don't make a book, because a book, I learned about writing, quite a bit of writing in this story, because up until now, my books have all been business books, which is really, to be flip, were three bullets that I extended into 200 pages. But this required an arc. This required a story. And so I'm proud of the story, which so much of it revolves around our daughter's wedding.
Yes, you mentioned that right off the bat with the walnut handrails on the stairs. This is where she's going to get married.
it's interesting, because this saga really talks about you learning three things, right? Writing, construction, and line building. It's a triple. It's like the triple crown you got going here, which is part of what made it so much fun to read.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, yeah, the arc of the story, this is where people need to understand that editors are necessarily not your friends, but they make books way better. And the arc of the story, there's two elements to the arc of the story that are so much fun. One, even though the house is falling down, it has a grand staircase. And I turned to my wife and said, "This would be a great place for Megan's wedding." And Carol looked at me and said, "She's 4 years old. And she just got married at the home." And what is so, is sort of a Disneyland or Disney ending. The audible version of the book is read by a fellow named George Newbern. And in the movie Father of the Bride with Steve Martin, he's the boy who marries Steve Martin's daughter. So it's like a story that could be true in a movie. It's great. And then he's now become a friend. George is a friend.
So let's talk a little more about let's finish with the construction process. How much more difficult and complex was it than you would have anticipated?
As someone who doesn't know a lot about construction, you know, sometimes I've said, you know, sometimes everything is a nail. So I am not handy. So everything was more complicated than I thought. Every single thing, changing a light switch is really hard to do for me without getting electrocuted. Everything was harder than I thought. We had a lot of friends because people took pity on me because of my lack of skills. So restoration is not for the lighthearted. If you're handy, I think it's way easier. And for people like me, you just develop a team. So we know when, you know, there's, I have a guy, whether it's electrical or plumbing or carpentry, there's a guy. And people love old houses. One of my favorite words right now is patina. I love the word patina, because it just shows that things are Well, things have been used. Things have been loved.
And patina doesn't just refer to copper. You know, a wood can have a patina. An old fishing boat has a patina to it.
Yeah. Or, in fact, I probably have a patina now from working on the house. But the, I want to be sure that your listeners know that the book is about restoration. It's about wine, but it's also about, you know, it's about what's important. It's about, you know, including the family in the things that you do. It's about creating a place. It's about how important family is, and about how meaning this, restoring this house gave our whole family meaning. This is something we were going to do with purpose, and we did it. So it just happened to be degree of difficulty high.
I think that's what really sucked me into the book, the fact that it was your family was involved in every aspect, from John not being able to sleep, finding the house, and now Brady runs the winery?
Yes, he does. Our oldest now runs the winery, and they each did find their own spot in the place, and never, so it also becomes a place of gathering. Mm-hmm. So, you know, every parent wants a place where they want their own home to be the place where all the other kids come around so they can see that they don't get into trouble. And that's what this became. So, and our house, we were splitting our time with San Francisco, and our house in the city had a backyard of, you know, 8 by 10 feet. So this was the opposite of that.
So that takes us to an interesting transition. We've been focusing on the house. Meanwhile, the house is sitting in the middle of a bunch of grapes. Talk to us about the status of the potential vineyard when you got there, and the process of getting that up and ready for action.
Yeah, well, the title of the book is The Accidental Vineyard, because it was an accident. The house, our property is surrounded on all four sides by a huge vineyard owned by a major wine company. And so when they plant a new vineyard, they might, I can't even imagine, 100,000 vines, 200,000 vines. And one day the vineyard manager came over to our house and said, hey, we have an extra 1,000 Cabernet plants, and rather than return them, we'll put them on your property if you'd like. I said, well, how much damage can I do? the next day it was Merlot. The next day it was Syrah. The next day it was Cabernet Franc. So we created a field blend, and they put them in the ground for us. And it's sort of like, you know, if somebody offers you a free boat, there's no such thing as a free boat. So now the vines are in the ground, and I learned a lot about viticulture. And after a few years, we developed a good wine. And for the first years were a little rocky, but now we make a red blend that's really good at Moran Manor.
What were some of the biggest surprises throughout the whole thing? Whether this restoration, becoming a wine manager, if you will, both positive and negative. What were the biggest surprises?
One of the things that my wife and I agreed on when we first bought the property is, let's take our time as we restore it and develop the vineyard. But it's a good thing we did agree to that, because everything takes a long time. No matter what the project is, the big surprise is it always takes longer than you think. And I don't know how people, you know, restore a home quickly, because there's everything takes long. That was a big surprise. Another surprise was, and a pleasant surprise, was the community that's in wine country. People help each other. People do not compete. I don't compete with any of the other vineyards. We're all distinct. And so we help each other. And in the book, I talk about how difficult it is for a city slicker to learn how to drive a tractor. So after a couple mishaps, we do not have a tractor. And when we need one, we just call one of the neighbors who has a tractor and knows how to drive it. So the community was a nice surprise. Maybe on the negative side,
Bats.
Well, the bats. Bats in the house. Well, a negative surprise is how difficult it is to get rid of bats when they're in your house, because they're it's a protected species, and I love bats because they eat so many mosquitoes. I just don't want them flying around in my bedroom at night.
That was the funnest section when they slammed into the window.
Oh yeah. So I should mention that we're not talking about, you know, a couple little fuzzy bats. We're talking about thousands of bats. The house was infested with bats, and they were difficult to get rid of. So it took years to get rid of the bats. And the agreement in the family was that no one could ever take a video of me trying to catch a bat, because it's like trying to hit a knuckleball. I mean, they come out and then they curve. I mean, you know, they're beautiful animals, but they're destructive, and in the house at night they keep you up. So we knew that one of the fireplaces was full of bats. So we, rather than me deal with it, we got an exterminator who specialized in this. He wasn't going to kill them, but he called himself Batman, literally. So he lit a fire in the fireplace in question with Sunday edition of the New York Times, full of smoke. The bats all flew out the chimney, and then he put a lid on the top of the chimney, a mesh screen, and boom, you know, after a big expense, the bats are gone out of the chimney, except they weren't. So when we discovered that the bats were still there, weeks later, a month later, I said, well, I'm not going to get that guy back here. He was expensive. So I lit a fire in the fireplace and went about my business. And a little bit later, the kids were all screaming and yelling, because in our library next where the fireplace is located, it was full of bats, about 20 bats flying around, and they were all on fire. None of them, they all lived to end of the day. The kids and I had hockey sticks and brooms and lacrosse sticks and got them all out of the house. But you haven't lived until there's 20 bats flying around in your house on fire. And of course, the danger is they land on a curtain or they land somewhere. The whole house burns down.
It's an old, an old wooden Victorian, of course.
Yeah. So they were, that was the first time, that this was probably 2 years in, where my wife and I sat down at 9 o'clock in the morning over a glass of wine and said, do you think we really made the right decision in buying this house?
I guess when you're on a vineyard, you can drink wine at 9 a.m.
Yeah, exactly.
I think you can.
Exactly. So now how did your time spent restoring the Victorian, planting the vineyard, caring for the vines, change your perspective towards your day job or jobs? Mm-hmm. Because you had a couple of them during the...
Well, I was conflicted because I was in management consulting, and I loved management consulting. I'd fly around the world consulting with CEOs and important people, and that was a heady job. But the trick, I guess the moment that I knew I was moving more toward the country was when I was on a conference call with an important CEO, and... while I was on the conference call on my cell phone, I was also clipping grapevines. And it was click, click, click. And we're talking about EBITDA or return on investment or something. And the CEO said, what is that clicking noise? Someone needs to stop that clicking noise. And it was me clipping the grapes. So I stopped. But it was then I realized I can't do both. So over time, we migrated, and I'm not a retired story, but I don't fly around the world consulting with CEOs anymore.
Good for you.
In fact, what my wife says is he's not retired, but he doesn't have a job.
So do you still do a little bit of management consulting, just not so much flying?
Yes. Okay. Yeah. The world has changed.
You don't need to anymore.
Yeah.
You know,
since, imagine how much the world has changed since 1995 when we first bought the house, between video conferences and just the efficiencies of working with teams.
Yeah. Now, this is a story of someone who has navigated a pretty substantial change to their lifestyle, to their vocation, to all those things. Do you have any advice for someone who is listening to this and thinking, yeah, I want to do that?
Yeah, I do have some advice. And part of this is out of my business book writing. The regrets that we have in life are the things that we decide not to do. Mm-hmm. I should have gone to medical school. I should have taken that job when I was younger. We should have had children. I should have married that girl in college or boy in college. So if you're considering it, I suggest you really explore the possibilities and then take it, if you understand what all the risks are, take that risk. So we took the risk. I mean, an old house that I didn't know how to fix up, developing a vineyard that I didn't know how to develop, two huge risks that changed our family's trajectory and our family's story. So my one piece of advice is just remember that the regrets that we have in life are the things that we chose not to do, and make that decision if you're going to do it, because the world right, I get that question a lot, and the world right now is so complicated and so disarming, so, you know, unpredictable, that people want to get away to a more simple life. And I think that if you want to do that, then you can take that risk and don't look back and say, I should have done that.
Yeah, exactly. Now, how about, do you measure success differently now than you did, say, 30 years ago? And if so, how do you measure success?
Measuring success is always tricky, but one thing I keep in mind is that when you're in college, when you're younger, and you're faced with a decision, sometimes you ask yourself, what's the worst that can happen to me? If I fail this exam in economics, what's the worst that can happen to me? And somewhere along the line, I switched over later in life into, when I'm making a decision, it's what's the best thing that can happen to me instead of the worst thing? And that's sometimes how I make decisions. But it's also, I measure success in, not in money for sure, not in possessions for sure. Everybody will tell you that. But it's in, I think, meaning. It's being able to get up every day and say, wow, you know, I really want to make some birdhouses today for the Western bluebirds. And I can do that. I have the option to do that. And that's success. So it's not about money. It's about feeling like you're doing something meaningful every day and contributing. And I also wake up every day and I listen to the Toby Keith song, Don't Let the Old Man In, which it's a song I love. And I'm fighting him off. He keeps knocking on my door and I'm not letting him in.
Good. Keep him at bay. So what is next for, what's the next chapter for Moran Manor?
Well, it is now, the kids are grown. They've all, now we have four grandchildren who, you know, when your grandfather owns a winery that's full of bicycles and go-karts and BB guns, you know, they all want to visit. So it remains the place. The place that we created is there. It still exists and it's thriving. So we're just, you know, people say, well, how long did it take you to restore the house? We're still restoring it. Everything takes long. And when it's a big old house, something is always breaking and needs restoration. So we still love the house and we still make the wine and involve friends in helping to pick the grapes. And it's a place still full of adventures.
The book is The Accidental Vineyard. And the author, Richard Moran, we just spent quite a few minutes, learning about restoring an old Victorian, planting wine vines, and caring for them. Richard, thank you so much for writing the book and sharing your time with us.
Thanks so much, guys.